Welcome to Module 2 in the Taming Your Tech Habits Masterclass. In this module, we're going to examine how screens might be sabotaging your sleep and how in turn this might be compromising both your physical health, your mental well-being, and also your productivity. You see, sleep really is the silver bullet, yet it's something that so many of us disregard, or that many of us, in fact, wear like a badge of honor when we say, you know, I'm not getting enough sleep. And in this increasingly hyper-connected world, where many of our organizations now expect us to be on call and to answer emails 24/7, this is an important topic for not only us, but for the companies that we might work for, or for the people that we also work with. And it's something that requires our urgent and critical attention. So my goal for this module is to help rescue your sleep from your screen. Again, with all of these modules, this is not about digital abstinence. This is not about demonizing technology. This is about us finding healthy, sustainable, long-term strategies that will enable us to both use technology, but in a way that won't compromise our health, well-being, and performance. So we're going to explore how screens are actually interfering with our sleep, both in terms of how much and the quality of the sleep that we're getting, because we know that screens are a little bit like digital caffeine. They cause it to take us longer to fall asleep. We wake up more frequently if we've been consuming them, and they interfere with our natural processes that actually help us to wake up feeling alert and ready to take on the day. You see, quality sleep impacts everything. It literally underpins our physical health, our mental well-being, our performance, and our productivity. So I want to ask you, and you can just nod along here in agreement, do you reach for your phone before your partner first thing in the morning? Some research is telling us that about 82% of us, if we are in a partnership, do reach for our phone before our partner first thing in the morning. Do you have a digital teddy bear? Are you taking your phone to bed with you, as we know many of us are? So we'll explore this in this issue, in this particular module, because we have a real problem when we have contraptions like the one you see on the screen for people to try and rescue or remedy the absence of sleep that they're getting. When we have in some Asian countries devices like this, the chin holder opera and the plunger suction cap with a warning sign in it to say, wake me up at this particular stop, when we are so chronically sleep deprived. And part of this is an endemic, I think, sociological issue. Many of us wear busyness like a badge of honor, and we pride ourselves on a lack of sleep. But many top performing executives, many elite athletes will all acknowledge that their performance is underpinned by good quality sleep. So the first thing that you need to do in this module is to complete a sleep journal. This is just a PDF sheet. I ask you just to do it for 1 week, just to monitor your sleep. Again, you don't need to submit this data. It's not tracked in any way. It's just a PDF sheet that you can download and just keep a written record of your sleep quality, quantity, because over the course of the week, we can start to see some sleep habits and patterns that we might be able to tweak and modify as well. So if you haven't already done so, pause the video, download your sleep journal, and for the course of about a week, keep a running record of how much sleep you're getting and also the quality of the sleep as well, and some of your habits around that, because that will enable us to make some changes, perhaps if you require them. So what I'd like to talk about in this particular module is how screen time is impacting and an absence of sleep is impacting on your well-being, your health, your performance, and your productivity. You know, insufficient sleep or poor quality sleep negatively impacts on our alertness. It impacts our capacity to learn. It impedes memory formation. We've got brain scans that actually show that when we are tired, we commit information to the wrong part of the brain. It impacts our emotional health, our capacity to to concentrate. It adversely impacts our immunity. This is often why we get sick when we're feeling really tired and run down. We're a lot more susceptible to infections. It adversely impacts our reaction time. Poor sleep quality and quantity over a period of time is directly related to obesity rates. And we know that even just a simple lack of sleep, you know, a study has shown that even 30 minutes of missed sleep on one night can result in an IQ difference of 10 points. So 30 minutes less sleep, an IQ drop of 10 points, which is rather substantial. Being awake for 17 hours or more is the equivalent to driving under the influence. So we know that we need minimal amounts of sleep, and we'll talk about how much and the quality of the sleep in just a moment. But we know that an absence of sleep can cause a whole lot of physical health concerns. One of them we know in terms of our immune system is that after one night of only 4 to 5 hours sleep, our body makes less of the anti-cancer killer cells called natural killer cells. So basically, sleep has been shown to reduce our chance of cancer of the bowel, breast, and prostate. And this was such a significant finding that the World Health Organization recently classed shift work as a probable carcinogen. So it basically impacts on our cardiovascular system, and it's a bit like, basically acts like blood pressure medication. So we know that there are so many functions that sleep performs. It is not just purely for rest purposes. So what we know is that the part of the brain, and I mentioned this in module one, the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that's just behind our forehead, this is the logical part of the brain. This is the part of the brain that's akin to being the CEO or the air traffic control system. This part of the brain makes responsible, logical, smart decisions. If you're a parent, the bad news is that this part of the brain doesn't fully develop until the 20s for most kids. So for boys, we know their prefrontal cortex develops in their late 20s, and for females, it's in the early 20s. But this part of the brain, it helps with what we call executive functioning. So it's all our higher order cognitive, our thinking skills. It's our problem solving, our reasoning, our organizing, our inhibition, planning, executing of plans. Basically, this part of the brain helps us get things done. But it has been long established from a whole lot of research that these executive functions are really adversely affected with too little sleep. Our brain can, in most instances, we know, for example, the visual cortex and the motor region of the brain will deteriorate when we don't get enough sleep. We find it harder to pay attention. We become less coordinated. This is why we often have accidents or trip over when we're tired. But these skills are nowhere near as impaired as what the prefrontal cortex is when we're tired. This part of the brain, that prefrontal cortex, manages our impulses. So this is why we're tired. We reach for poorer food choices. And so we can see that, you know, a work environment in terms of our performance, a tired state will have a really big impact on our output and, as I mentioned before, our well-being. So how much sleep do we need? This is again based on science and research, and we know that the average adult requires 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night on average. That's the amount of sleep. People that say, you know, I'm a Steve Jobs, I only need a really small amount of sleep. Only it is estimated that about 3% of the population can live on less than the 7 to 9 hours of recommended sleep a night. A very, very small proportion of people can actually thrive off less than that. Many people who suggest that they don't need a lot of sleep are perhaps being deluded themselves. The other thing we know is that we not only need a good amount of sleep, we need good quality of sleep. We need to make sure that we are getting completed sleep cycles. And in the next slide, I'm going to explain how screens might be impacting not only how much sleep we get, but also the quality of the sleep as well. So we know that when it comes to the amount of sleep, basically if we are using a technology before we go to bed, particularly if it's a handheld technology, it's our phone, it's our tablet device, it can delay the onset of sleep for two reasons. The first and most obvious reason is because technology and our handheld devices emit blue light, and blue light suppresses the body's production of melatonin. And melatonin is the sleep hormone that the pineal gland in the brain releases to start to help us feel tired. However, because our screens emit blue light tricks the body into thinking it's still time for us to stay awake. So this is why we need to avoid using screens. Now, ideally for adults, the research says an hour before we want to fall asleep should be a what Jocelyn Brewer, psychologist Jocelyn Brewer, calls a digital sunset. We really should be having a bedtime for our devices about an hour before we want to physically fall asleep, at the very least. We also know what we're doing on a screen before we fall asleep can impact us. So if we're watching rapid fire, fast paced screen action, if we are typing and being more interactive as opposed to passive, you know, it's very different to sitting and watching a Netflix show or watching something when we're a lot more passive as opposed to perhaps gaming or responding to emails or writing, you know, an important proposal. So what we're doing on a screen is also really critical, particularly in that hour before we want to go to sleep. And the other way that screens are impacting on quantity of sleep is literally just the displacement effect. If we are spending more and more time on our screens, it is in many instances encroaching on the available hours that we have for sleep. So we need to make sure that we are really preserving that 7 to 9 hour period each night in terms of the amount. Now, the other way that screens are impacting our sleep is the quality of our sleep. And we know that if we have devices in bedrooms, and even, I'm going to take it in two levels here, in two stages, even if we've got the device switched off, we've got it perhaps on airplane mode or it's on do not disturb, which I really strongly encourage you to do. But even if it is on those particular modes and we wake up naturally to go to the bathroom, if our phone is in close proximity, if it's in our sleeping area, just seeing the device charging on our bedside table, on the dresser, in the bathroom, wherever it is that you have it, can be a mental trigger, and it can act as a stimulus for us to start to think about, I wonder if I got a reply to that email. I wonder how many likes my Instagram post got. And it can be that catalyst for disrupting our sleep quality. The other thing we know is that sadly, many of us are actually sleeping with our phones in our bedrooms, and we do not have them on do not disturb or on sleep mode or airplane mode. And so we are literally having alerts and notifications wake us during the night. So when we sleep, we go through these five stages of sleep. And each of these stages are really critical. It's in the latter two stages, in stages 4 and 5 when we sleep, where we commit things to memory. This is where our long-term memory is formed, and interrupted or incomplete cycles mean that we are not getting to those latter stages of sleep. And so our memory-making capacity is being impacted, because often we get an alert or notification, we check it, we go back to sleep, and then we start the sleep cycle again. So we're not often getting sufficient number of completed sleep cycles. So really critical that we preserve both the amount and the quality of sleep that we get every single night. So what are realistic solutions when it comes to ensuring that screens aren't sabotaging our sleep? As I mentioned in the earlier module, this isn't about digital abstinence, and I'm not going to propose that you don't use your phone at all at night. Instead, what I'm going to suggest in this part of the module is realistic, pragmatic, long-term strategies that we can implement to foster healthy habits with sleep. So first and foremost, we need to keep technology out of bedrooms. Even if our phone is on silent, it can be, remember, a mental trigger for us to see it. So keeping it out of the bedroom is the ideal model. Now, if there is no other alternative, you can't buy an alarm clock, the thought of being away from your device is near impossible, having it out of eyeline. So popping it on charge in your wardrobe, popping it underneath the bed, putting it in your ensuite so that it is not a visual reminder and trigger for you to reach for it first thing, and for you also not to be thinking about it if you do happen to wake up naturally. We know that keeping devices out of bedrooms is associated with good sleep hygiene. You see, we want bedrooms to be associated with two S's, not three, and they are sleep and sex, not sleep, sex, and screens. We really need to make sure that we preserve bedrooms as a tech-free zone. Some other strategies that we can implement is to prescribe or to enforce a digital bedtime. Just like most of us have a rough time that we go to sleep each night, coming up with a cutoff time, a time where we actually unplug, disconnect, pop devices away, can work really effectively. Now, ideally, this would be 60 minutes before we go to sleep. Some research even suggests up to 90 minutes before we want to fall asleep naturally should be screen-free, but that 60 minutes is sort of the ideal amount. What I recommend is that if you are going to implement this new habit, if this has been a long habit for you to have adopted, if you have been, you know, habitually scrolling through social media or checking emails one last time before you go to bed, this can sometimes be a really hard habit to break. And we're going to talk in the next module a lot more about healthy habits and how to create habitual change. But for now, what I'm going to say is we usually find that the greatest success is when we crowd out the unhealthy habit. So rather than starting saying, I'm just going to cut off technology at 8 o'clock and I'll find something to do, crowd out that old habit by saying at 8 o'clock every night, I'm going to start reading my book. Or at 9 o'clock every night, I'm popping my phone away and instead I'm going to hop in the bath, or I'm going to go for a walk around the block, or I'm going to go and do a crossword puzzle. Whatever it is, we know the research tells us that in most instances, just stopping a behavior is really hard, but where we can crowd it out with something else, it's a bit like diversional therapy, it can work particularly effectively. The next thing I'm going to say is at night, this is just general sleep hygiene, we need to keep our houses as dark as possible. Basically, it helps to regulate our circadian rhythms. So the last 2 to 3 hours before we fall to sleep should be as dark as possible. So in the moment, I'm going to show you some tools that you can use on your devices to minimize the blue light that comes from your devices. But for now, I just want to talk about how we can use our physical environment, you know, shutting curtains, closing blinds, dimming if you've got lights with dimmers on them, using candles, you know, turning off fluorescent lights, popping on lamps, anything that we can do to help regulate our circadian rhythms. Now, we have often tended to do this naturally, but it's even more important that we do it now in this digital age because our bodies are becoming dysregulated and becoming immune to the amount of blue light that they're constantly absorbing. So 2 to 3 hours trying to dim the lights in your house will really have a profound impact on your sleep. When it comes to your digital device, controlling the brightness of the screen and using filters can be another great strategy to minimize blue light exposure. So for example, on any screen, be it a tablet, smartphone, laptop, desktop computer, simply using the brightness function, literally turning down the brightness of the screen, will stop your eyes from absorbing as much of the blue light. On iOS devices, using the night shift mode, you can go into your settings, and again in your PDF summary sheet, there are step-by-step instructions, and this will vary over time due to upgrades, etc., and updates. But you can, on all smartphones and tablets, you can use a night shift mode in iOS devices. And on Android, there are some apps that you can use. There's a blue light filter app that's available in the the Google Play Store. Basically, these apps allow you, and these tools allow you to change the brightness of the screen and to change the light being emitted, so that it's not that blue light. On laptops and desktop computers, I highly recommend an app or a plugin called Flux. It again allows you to control the brightness emitted from the screen. Another strategy that works really well at fostering healthy sleep habits in the digital age is to establish landing zones. Prescribing a specific place in your house, this works particularly well if you are a parent and you've got kids and their digital appendages to manage as well. But having a specific allocated spot in the house where the 15 iPads, 12 laptops, 7 smartphones go, it is a charging station, and it can be anywhere from the kitchen counter to an office table to a breakfast buffet bar, anywhere that is a designated spot, ideally outside of bedrooms. This helps us to create really good habits, and it again keeps the technology out of bedrooms. As I mentioned in module 1, we can also wear blue light blocking glasses, and the ones that I recommend and personally use are by Baxter Blue. These glasses stop your eye from absorbing the blue light. These glasses block about 60% of the blue light, so they have quite a profound effect on our capacity to sleep if we need to break the rules or bend the rules a little, and we need to be using our devices before we go to sleep. These glasses can be a really great assistive tool. I also recommend wearing them throughout the day. These are great in terms of preventing our eyes from absorbing that cumulative exposure to blue light as well. A really practical strategy, but so effective, is one that I call avoiding email at night. As I mentioned in module one, the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that helps us make logical, smart decisions, it powers down at night. It literally shuts off. And instead, the part of the brain that takes over at night is the amygdala. It's part of the limbic part of the brain. And this part of the brain, for want of a better word, is the emotional part of the brain. So our logical, smart brain turns off and our emotional brain turns on at night. This is why you may have noticed from experience, we tend to have more arguments with our spouses and our children at night than any other time of the day. And this is where things like email, where interpersonal communication, you know, internal communications within a company, our client emails can be particularly problematic, because at night our logical brain is off and we have a heightened emotional state. So it means we're more likely to send perhaps a terse email. We might send an email that we may later regret. So we really need to make sure that we avoid using emails at night. And some companies have actually gone, for example, Volkswagen in 2012 went to the great extent of actually imposing blackout times on work emails. So their servers literally stopped pushing emails out for non-management employees between the hours of 6 p.m. and 7 a.m. Now, this obviously doesn't work in multinational companies. It can often be problematic in knowledge-based companies because it would be disruptive and counterproductive. It is worth us considering perhaps company policies or even just personal policies that I don't email at a set time. Maybe you want to set up an autoresponder, and we'll talk about this in later modules, saying that you're unavailable if someone is to contact you within those parameters or within your personal boundaries. Or perhaps it's just a personal boundary that you enforce, knowing that you have a blackout time on when you don't respond to emails. Another strategy is to implement a screen swap. So instead of swiping on your phone or scrolling through social media, a better choice at night would be to listen to a mindfulness app or listen to music or listen to an audiobook. There's obviously the absence of a visual component in that those particular types of examples. Watching television instead of scrolling through or responding to emails is a much better choice, because it tends to be a more passive activity. So yes, I am suggesting that Netflix would be a better alternative than social media before we go to sleep. Obviously, the content is important. If it's too scary or too exciting, it can have a hyperarousal effect. But in most instances, watching something as opposed to typing or interacting tends to be a more passive activity. Kindles are also a great choice. These devices do not emit blue light. Most ebook readers do not. So a Kindle would be a better choice than an iPad. So just making screen swaps would be something that could really benefit our sleep. We also need to make sure that we are not drowning in information. One of the reasons that we, as I mentioned in module one, we're feeling increasing rates of anxiety is because we have reached our cognitive threshold. Our brains have that maximum load. So if we are working particularly late at night, it can overload our brain and cause unnecessary stress and anxiety. So this is where we can use technology to our advantage. This is where we can offload some of the tasks that we're trying to commit to our memory by popping it in our calendar, writing a to-do list that syncs on our multiple devices. Perhaps it's sending some tasks to our assistant or to our colleague. Basically, we need to free up our brain so that we can switch off and power down at night. The other thing that we know to help you with your sleep is napping. And we have ample evidence about the benefits of napping. But there are some really important caveats and rules. And I want to go through the nap now in quite a bit of detail. So rule number one, when it comes to napping, do not take a nap if you have any trouble either falling asleep or staying asleep at night. The problem is that if we try and take naps, we stop our bodies from building up something called sleep pressure during the day. So sleep pressure builds up naturally during the day and it peaks right before we fall asleep at night. However, If you take a nap during the day, what you're actually doing is decreasing your sleep pressure, and it makes it harder for you to fall asleep or to sleep through the night. So basically what we want to do is to create high sleep pressure at night, and that will help us fall asleep, stay asleep, and it helps us to wake up not too early. However, if you have trouble sleeping at night, it's important to have high sleep pressure at night, and having a nap will be counterproductive in that regard. You also need to decide on how much time you have available for your nap. So there are two types of naps. There's the power nap and there is a recovery nap. A power nap is where we sleep for a maximum of 20 minutes, and this prevents us from going into a deep sleep. So many of us fall into this sort of nap sometimes when we're lying on the lounge, and it enables us to fall asleep, but it's not the deep sleep that's unpleasant and difficult to wake up from. This short nap is only a light sleep, so it's very easy for us to wake up afterwards, and it still has a really positive impact on our attention and concentration levels. In fact, studies have shown us that we have bolstered attention and focus for up to 3 hours after a 20-minute nap. So it is definitely time well spent, and it needs to be considered something like a time investment rather than something that would inhibit our performance. The second type of nap we have is a recovery nap, and this nap is much longer than the power nap. The recovery nap is where we set an alarm and we sleep for no more than 90 minutes. And what we know is that when we sleep for about 90 minutes, what we're actually doing is getting a full sleep cycle in. So most of us will go through these 5 stages of sleep during that 90-minute period. So it can be incredibly beneficial for us to have one of these longer naps. Now, the recovery nap usually means we get into light and deep sleep, and we may even get into that REM, that dream sleep state as well. We know that these types of naps can have a really positive effect on our attention, our memory, our mood, and also on our physical health. Another really important rule when it comes to napping, I didn't realize that napping became so serious, is that we shouldn't really take a nap on a Sunday. Now, we might have the opportunity for naps during the week, or many of us seem to have formed an association that Sunday afternoons are a great nap time, and they can be really counterproductive. They really can backfire on us. We, again, know that any type of nap will diminish our sleep pressure, but a long nap, so that recovery nap, will really significantly impact our capacity to fall asleep. And I think many of us have been in that predicament where we think we're doing the right thing and having a catch-up nap on a Sunday, and we are still lying there awake after midnight trying to fall asleep. The issue is with the Sunday nap is that many of us, we're not building up the sleep pressure. Second of all, many of us have trouble falling asleep naturally on a Sunday because of the stress associated with returning to work on Monday and deadlines and routines, etc. And the third reason is that many of us actually have a sleep in on a Sunday morning, which means our brain has had even less time to build up sleep pressure throughout the day. So it's the lack of accumulated sleep pressure and the added stress of a Sunday night that means that a recovery nap would be much better placed on the weekend on a Saturday as opposed to a Sunday. Some other points to consider before you pop your head on your desk or dart off to the sleeping pod in your office: consider the time. The research tells us ideally between 2 and 3 p.m. Is the most beneficial time in your local area for you to engage in a nap. This coincides with a dip in your biological clock, so it means there'll still be sufficient time to build up sleep pressure after your nap, and it's also the time of the day when most of us receive an energy dip, our biological clock. We start to get tired. This is why many of us start to reach for coffee and for sugar late in the afternoon. So a nap could be a good substitute for engaging in unhealthier activities. And the second tip is, after you've had a nap, it's really important to do something physically active. You don't need to go for a long, you know, walk around the block. A simple burst of activity, you know, 10 seconds of star jumps, or going into the cubicle in the bathroom and doing some squats, shaking our arms about, anything to get us energized, much like we do in the morning when we wake up and we have a bit of a stretch and we move around. It will be a good return on investment. I don't know if we need devices like this in our sleeping pods. This was a contraption that was designed by somebody where it was sunk to her phone. So after her 20-minute power nap, she would receive a slap on the head to wake her up. I don't know if we need to go to those lengths. Another strategy to foster your sleep is to make sure, as I mentioned in the previous module, that we're getting natural sunlight. Not only does it prevent the onset of myopia, which is that nearsightedness in our eyes, but it also helps to regulate our circadian rhythms. We know that when we get sleep in the morning, and even as something as simple as having your blinds or your curtains open in the morning as you wake up, getting out in natural sunlight between the hours of 8 a.m. and 12 p.m. in particular will help to regulate your circadian rhythm. We also know an added benefit is that it is very closely associated with an increase in your metabolism too. So early morning light is connected to a low body mass index. So getting outside, numerous studies have shown for about 20 to 30 minutes in that first half of the day will really help to reset our circadian rhythms and to counteract a lot of the blue light that we tend to be getting through our screen use throughout the day. If you live in a part of the world where it is difficult to get this, perhaps you are traveling, or perhaps your routine for whatever reason means that it is difficult to get that time out in natural sunlight, even using a lamp when you first thing in the morning when you wake up, this makes it much easier for you to stay awake. So the general rule of thumb is that we want to work with our biological clock and our circadian rhythms. So that means we need to get lots of light early in the morning. This helps your clock run faster, and it also means that you will tend to fall asleep quicker, earlier, and easier at night. So the general rule of thumb, early lots of light in the morning and trying to minimize and reduce our light exposure throughout the day as we fall asleep. There are also, believe it or not, some brilliant technologies that help us manage sleep, particularly if we have to travel for either work or pleasure. There are some incredible jet lag apps. The one that I recommend and personally use myself is called Time Shifter, and it works on both Android and iOS devices. And it's based on the latest research in sleep and in circadian neuroscience. Time Shifter uses scientific principles that have been proven to show what will help to reset our circadian rhythms. So we know, for example, as I mentioned before, light exposure and melatonin supplements. They've also used this app to show what alleviates the symptoms of jet lag. So things like, again, melatonin, caffeine, and naps. So this app works with you and helps you to figure out what time zone you are traveling from and what time zone you are traveling to. And it prescribes what times of the day you need to be either taking a nap, having caffeine, cutting it off, or going to sleep to help you regulate your circadian rhythm as quickly as possible. I highly recommend that app, even if you're just someone who does sort of east to west coast Australian trips. It can make a really profound difference. The other thing we could consider in terms of technology, rather ironically, is that there are a plethora of sleep apps. Now, I'm reluctant to recommend sleep apps where you actually need to have the phone in close proximity whilst you are sleeping. It's very contradictory when I'm saying keep technology out of your bedroom. In some instances, there are definitely merits for doing that. For people with really significant sleep problems where it has been prescribed by a medical practitioner, I think there are definitely reasons to use those. On the whole, though, I recommend perhaps not using apps again in your bedroom. The app I recommend is called Shleep, and you don't have to have this in close proximity. The reason that I recommend this app is that it, first of all, will guide you through your sleep habits. It will help make personalized suggestions based on your current patterns and behaviors. But the reason that I particularly like it is that it has an educational component along with this app. So have a look at Shleep. I think at the moment it is only available on the iOS store, but it provides you with habitual information, data, and strategies that you can use to really improve your sleep habits and routines, and it takes less than 5 minutes a day. I know some of the sleep apps that I've looked at previously require quite a significant amount of time to set them up and then to monitor them and use them as well. So the last thing before we wrap up this module I want to talk about, and again, this may be something that is beyond your locus of control, But examining company policies where we work, whether you're a leader, an executive, or in a decision-making role, or whether you're somebody who wants to flag this with your colleagues, we really need policies and businesses to start valuing sleep. Arianna Huffington, who started the Huffington Post, in her book Thrive, really talks about why we need organizational shifts and companies just to start valuing the importance of sleep and to really foster that working culture in terms of promoting and acknowledging sleep. So what are some company policies that we could consider? Travel policies. You know, can companies and organizations encourage flexibility? So can we allow employees to take an earlier plane ride rather than taking the overnight red-eye flight so that they can get a good night's sleep before a meeting or a presentation? Can we facilitate team working? In the culture of 24/7 responsiveness, do we all need to be connected 24/7? Does one person bear the brunt of single-handedly, you know, dealing with inquiries? Can we offset some of this by providing different employee roles or having tag teams who hand over the reins to other teams in time zones? Can we set up an autoresponder that informs people who are contacting us or are emailing us that their complaint, their inquiry, their contact has been received and it will be responded to in due course? We'll talk about autoresponders in a later module, but it really provides us with reassurance that we have responded to inquiries, but it gives us that peace of mind that we don't have to be tethered to tech constantly. Can we use team working to our advantage and making sure that if we are having phone calls or video conferences, that it is mindful of local times and the preferences of all parties involved? And again, there are brilliant time conversion and calendar software tools that enable us to make better choices with that. You know, not forcing employees to wake up at 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning to be on a conference call where possible. Having work time limits. This is really a cultural shift in organizations. Many companies are actually now implementing rules to curb employees from working late every night. A really large banking institution recently required its summer interns to leave the office before midnight each night to ensure that they weren't being subjected to constant all-nighters. We've got some organizations enforcing lockout times where they're literally forcing employees out at particular times. We're seeing companies implementing mandatory work-free vacations where employees receive a bonus. A software company gives their employees $7,500 in a bonus if they abide by two rules. Number one, they actually have to go on vacation. They don't get the money. And number two, they have to disconnect. So they cannot take work, they cannot respond to emails. And if they adhere to those two guidelines, they receive a bonus. We've also got some companies implementing something called PTO, predictable time off. Leslie Perlow, who was a professor at Harvard Business School, introduced this as a strategy to catch up on lost sleep. So basically, it is a designated planned night off each week with absolutely no email, no work, no smartphone access. And Perlow's organization, she worked for a consulting firm, actually tracked productivity after they implemented the PTO strategy. And they found that employee productivity increased so substantially that this is now a company-wide program that they implement. Another strategy that companies can consider is physically supporting napping through the provision of napping rooms or pods. Or if that's not a possibility, and I understand in smaller companies or where the physical space is a constraint, even if it's not the provision of spaces where you can go and nap, encouraging employees to, you know, pop their head on their desk or go to a designated quiet space or to actually support the idea of a nap is really, really critical. So there we have sleep and how it's being sabotaged in the digital age. Hopefully you have completed your sleep journal for 7 nights. And if you haven't by now, please do that. Then I'm going to challenge you just to make some small changes. If you haven't already, moving your phone out of your bedroom, setting a bedtime for devices, coming up with a new sleep ritual if screens have been part of your previous sleep ritual before that. Coming up with strategies to dim both your screen and your physical space so that you can start to foster healthier sleep habits. And scheduling in some natural sunlight in the morning to help both your vision and also your circadian rhythms. That's it for module 2. Please feel free to complete the checklist below this video. Download the sleep journal and your PDF checklist, and I will see you in module 3, where we start to look at some pragmatic, realistic ways that we can foster healthier tech habits.